we'll get ready to go here. Thank you all for coming. This is just listened to Dave and Marco's meeting last time. They said they're one of the best. This must be the best session of the MVP virtual conference. And I'm Rob Mikshinsky. I'm the moderator for this session. I'll be doing the questions. So keep them on coming, and we will we'll get to them probably at the end of the session. But all kidding aside, this is a great session. It's very relevant to what we're doing in the marketplace right now with VMware and Hyper-V and kind of educating both sides of the fence here. And without further ado, I'll hand it over to Andy. He'll introduce himself, and we'll get right into the content. Andy, it's all yours.
All right. Hey, thanks, Rob. Yeah, Rob's going to kind of be moderating the session, as he said, and he'll be hopefully, taking care of some questions during the session if possible, and we might be holding some to the end as well. So again, thanks for attending the virtual conference today. I hope everyone's having a good time, getting some good info, and Rob and I are going to attempt to continue the trends. So this session really is going to be, as the title says, migrating from VMware to Hyper-V for VMware pros. So let's kind of get started. Whenever I like to preface this topic with, this is not going to turn into a let's bash VMware session. I always like to really, really kind of cover that topic, that point when I start presenting this topic, because as we know, as IT pros, we like what we like, right? We like VMware. Some of us like Hyper-V. It just depends. So this really is, like Rob said, relevant to our jobs as IT administrators. And a lot of administrators are starting to find themselves in a situation where maybe they're in a multi-hypervisor environment. Maybe they have Hyper-V hosts. Maybe they have VMware hosts. So the concept of consolidating all of these virtual workloads down into a single environment is something that a lot of us are having to work on. So today we're going to be focusing on going from the VMware side over to Hyper-V, and we're going to be doing that kind of through the prism of someone who's already worked with VMware and may not necessarily have worked with Hyper-V, but kind of have a general knowledge. So this is what I like to call the who the heck is this guy slide. Being as I'm a Microsoft MVP in Hyper-V, I tend to lose a little credibility from the VMware side, right? And I guess that's to be expected. But I guess let me start from the top here. So again, my name is Andy Sirwich, and I am a senior cloud services engineer with the Trivalent Group. The Trivalent Group is a services provider that's located in West Michigan, and we do all kinds of different things. We're an ISP. We provide cloud services. We do professional services, managed services, kind of the one-stop shop. Now, as far as Trivalent goes, again, I'm the senior cloud services engineer, and we provide private hosted clouds to our customers. And, Hyper-V is a great virtualization platform, and, personally, it's my preferred. But Trivalent's cloud platform is actually based on VMware. Trivalent years ago had made the decision to invest in VMware infrastructure, and it just hasn't made sense yet due to all those past investments. It hasn't made sense to migrate that to Hyper-V. So even though I am a Hyper-V MVP, I do spend a lot of time during my day job supporting VMware. So I kind of have the unique viewpoint of living in both worlds because of that. So this is a topic that I deal with day in and day out. So if anyone wants to email me after the session, maybe they have some questions, you just want to follow up, you want to get together for a cup of coffee, feel free to email me. I like to pride myself on being very approachable. So if you have any questions after the fact, please let me know. Unfortunately, I was being a little sadistic, I guess, when I came up with my domain name, and unfortunately, to email me, you're going to have to type out my last name, which sadly is not the easiest thing to remember, so my apologies on that. And apparently, I didn't get any smarter with the Twitter handle either, so you're going to have to deal with a last name there as well. So if we have any folks out there that really like to get involved on Twitter, I'm pretty active on Twitter, and feel free to follow me, and we'll go from there. I also do some blogging and some authoring on the side. I've got my own blog at sirwhichit.com. It's not as active as it used to be. It's kind of become more of an RSS feed of what I've done in the community lately. And then I also do some blogging for altero.com. That's www.altero.com/hyperv. And you'll find a lot of good Hyper-V-related content there as well. So let's cover our agenda for the session today. What are we learning in the session? Well, you know, if you look at the session description, talk about covering clustering. We talk about some management differences. Really, with 50 minutes, it's not a ton of time to cover clustering in Hyper-V in its entirety. So really what it's going to come out to is it's going to be a crash course on Hyper-V cluster architecture. Going to spend some time looking at the general architecture of a Hyper-V cluster, and I'm going to focus on pointing out the differences between a Hyper-V cluster and VMware. So we're also going to look at differences in management from vSphere. So in vSphere, you've kind of got the vSphere client, right, or the web interface, which really acts just like the vSphere client. And that really acts as your one-stop shop for all things management in vSphere, right? There are some key management differences in Hyper-V, which I'm really going to demo it, hoping the demo gods favor me today. But I'm not doing anything too crazy, so we should be okay. But really, I'm just kind of go through the management interfaces that are involved in Hyper-V, and we're gonna go from there. After that, we're going to get to what this session really is all about, doing virtual machine conversions from VMware into Hyper-V, and that is done via the Microsoft Virtual Machine Converter. And you may hear me refer to it as MVMC here and there throughout the session. Now, I put the bullet point underneath that that says focused on on-premise workloads. And there's a reason I put that in there. The main reason was because this particular utility will allow you to convert an on-premise physical machine or a virtual machine to an Azure VHD. So this utility can actually assist you in migrating that workload up into Azure as a virtual hard disk, which you then later attach that hard disk to a virtual machine inside of Azure. That's kind of outside the scope of this particular presentation. You're going to see it throughout the wizards that I use throughout the session, but I just kind of wanted to point that out. You're going to see that, but we won't be covering that in detail today. I might cover it, you know, just a little bit, but we're not going to cover it in detail in any way, shape, or form. Also, we're going to talk about the Migration Automation Toolkit briefly. That's kind of another one of those things that takes a little bit of time to explain and get through. But that's a tool that sits on top of MVMC, I guess, and really assists you in doing some more involved conversions when you're talking about large-scale virtual environments. And then after that, we'll do some wrap-up, and we'll do some Q&A as well. So first, I want to spend some time covering Hyper-V architecture. If you've worked in the VMware world for any length of time, you're going to find that a lot of this looks very, very similar. And even though they are different hypervisors, you're going to find that the architecture is very similar underneath. You know, the same rules apply, the same concepts apply. So the first thing we have is we have a standalone Hyper-V host. And that host will have local storage and some connectivity to the network in some way, shape, or form. And on the vSphere side, with a standalone ESXi host, this is going to be your most basic deployment, right? It's going to store the VM locally on the machine, and then you're going to use the network connectivity to get the VM traffic out to the physical network. But as we know, with virtual environments, one of the key benefits are high availability, live migrations, or in the VMware world, vMotion, right? Those are some of the key benefits of having a virtual environment. So you're not going to run into this situation very often where you have a standalone Hyper-V host. You might have this at like a branch office or a very, very small SMB customer, but you're not going to see this very often, just like the VMware side. So realistically, you're going to have two Hyper-V hosts or more. You might have a larger cluster than that as well, depending on your environment. And just like in VMware, to cluster Hyper-V hosts together, so you get those fancy things like high availability and live migrations, aka vMotion, we need some sort of shared storage fabric. Now, on the Hyper-V side, this could be a SAN, it could be a NAS, it could be something fancy like the newly announced Storage Spaces Direct feature that was announced at Ignite last week, which is kind of like a vSAN type of function, very similar to vSAN for those of you on the VMware side that are familiar with vSAN. You need some sort of shared storage that both the hosts can see at the same time to facilitate things like HA and live migrations. Kind of the same way on the networking side, no big surprises there. All of that VM traffic needs to be able to get out to the physical network, just like in VMware. And you're going to have some cluster live migration traffic that's involved as well. So you might have different VLANs, you might have different physical network infrastructures for those different traffic types, but in general terms, the architecture is really the same. So like I said, even though it's a different hypervisor, there's no secrets, there's no smokes and mirrors, it's all exactly the same from an architecture standpoint as VMware. So I kind of mentioned that there are some management differences. And again, on the VMware side, you have that vSphere client, which, again, is your one-stop shop, right? Well, in the Microsoft world, they already had some tools in place as they were starting to develop Hyper-V that kind of fit the mold as far as management goes. I mean, we had MMC and all the associated snap-ins. The System Center suite was an option. And really what you're going to find is that there are a couple different management options based on the size of the cluster or a standalone host. Based on the size of your Hyper-V infrastructure, there's different management tools that you would use for each different situation. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to switch over to my lab environment, and we're going to kind of walk through these management utilities one at a time. Now, the key reason I'm doing this is I remember when I was learning Hyper-V years ago, I remember this was one of the most jarring things. I was used to that single pane of glass. And kind of learning a couple different management utilities, that was a little difficult. But as you learn the utilities and start incorporating them in your daily management tasks, you're going to find that when you use them, starts to make sense based on the function or the job that you're trying to accomplish at that point in time. So this first one that I'm going to show everyone is the Hyper-V Manager. This is probably what I'd call your entry level Hyper-V management utility. This is mostly designed for those small deployments where you have maybe one or two hosts inside of a cluster. And just like your typical MMC snap-in, you can add in several servers in the left-hand pane here. So as you can see, I have a list of virtual machines that resides on TGLab-HV01. You see I've got a couple Linux servers. I've got a couple of running Hyper-V VMs here. It's a pretty intuitive interface. Here you can see checkpoints, which in the VMware world are called snapshots. Not sure why Microsoft didn't just call them snapshots here, but they're called checkpoints in the Microsoft world. So keep that in mind when you start managing Hyper-V environments. And you can manage those much like you would VMware snapshots as well. They are managed in very much the same way, and the same concepts and same behaviors apply. Down here you have kind of a general overview of the state of that virtual machine. You know, you get a little preview of the console and the hardware version of the virtual machine and the generation of the virtual machine. And, you know, clustered, yes, heartbeat, you know, just kind of the normal stuff that you're used to seeing even on the VMware side. Now, on the right-hand pane over here, you got a number of different options. You can import virtual machines that were previously exported. You can modify some Hyper-V settings, which I'll open now. And these are basically the general settings of the host itself. Things like storage targets, you know, GPU management, NUMA spanning, live migration settings. By default, live migrations will allow two simultaneous at a given time. You can modify this, but when you modify it, you definitely want to take into account your network your network hardware. You know, if you only have gig infrastructure and you're sharing it with some other function, you might want to think twice about changing the default. But if you've got an insane 40 gig NIC infrastructure and you really want to leverage that, you can definitely come in here and change that. I got storage migrations, kind of the same concept as live migrations here, but for storage. Enhanced session mode, this allows you to do some cool things like copy files in and out of the console and things like that. Replication, this is mainly if you're using Hyper-V Replica, which we're not going to cover in this particular session. And then some user settings down here. Excuse me. So from there, the other big thing that I like to point out in this interface is the virtual switch manager. That's the other part of this interface that I'm really gonna focus on. So as you can see in this particular environment, I only have a single vSwitch. This is a lab environment that I use quite frequently, and it's not too complex, but if you had more than one vSwitch, you would definitely start seeing them here. So I've got one vSwitch that's just labeled to LAN, and you've got a couple of different options here. Connection type. You know, this is an external network, basically meaning this vSwitch is attached to an external NIC, well, not an external NIC, but a NIC that's in the host, right, and is connected to the external network. Very much like a VMware vSwitch, kind of the same concept. Internal network, what this network type is for internal traffic on the host between the VMs and the host itself. And then you have private network. The only difference between private and internal is that private will exclude the host. So the VMs can talk to each other on that private network. The host will never be involved in that traffic. So keep that in mind. I've got some VLAN options here as well and things like that. So not much else more to cover in this area. You know, like I said, just kind of want to focus on the basic differences between VMware and Hyper-V. So I have a couple other options over here. If you want to edit a virtual hard disk, you know, like you want to increase the size of it, you would actually say edit disk here, and you'd run through this wizard. You would browse to the disk that you wanted to modify, and then you would make your changes to it. It's a little bit different from the VMware side, where you actually drill down into the VM settings, find your hard disk and expand it. In the Hyper-V world, in Hyper-V Manager, you'd actually go in through here and say edit disk. If you just want information on a particular disk, you'd say inspect disk. And then, you know, your stop service, remove server, you know, most of the things that you want to stay away from in an established Hyper-V environment. So that's Hyper-V Manager. That's, like I said, kind of your basic entry-level Hyper-V management utility. So I'm going to minimize that and going to go over to Failover Cluster Manager. Now, as I mentioned earlier, Microsoft already had some tools out there that they could use for Hyper-V management. And when I think of that sentence, this utility is one of those things that comes to mind, because Failover Cluster Manager is used for so many different things, right? You can use it for file server clusters and things like that. There's all different kinds of clustered roles that you can manage with Failover Cluster Manager. But a lot of people don't really see it as a utility for managing Hyper-V. It really throws a lot of people off. But in those situations where you have 2, 3, maybe up to a 10-node cluster, maybe even higher depending on your organization, this is really your utility for managing those types of situations. It'd be used in a situation where you have that number of clustered nodes, clustered Hyper-V hosts, and you don't have System Center in play. System Center is a costly product, right? And a lot of small businesses and medium-sized businesses don't really utilize it in their environments. So this would be the management utility that those types of organizations would use to manage their Hyper-V environments. So as you'll see in here, you know, you've got your roles. This terminology throws a couple people off because they don't really see a virtual machine as a clustered role. But in the Microsoft world, the terminology is that type virtual machine can be a clustered role inside of a failover cluster. You've also got nodes. They're clustered Hyper-V nodes. These are each of the Hyper-V the Hyper-V hosts that are contained inside of this cluster. And I can click on those clustered nodes, and I can actually get some nice information about the host itself. I can see the uptime. I can see the memory that's in the machine. These aren't the beefiest hosts, but they get the job done for a lab environment. You know, got the processors, CPU usage, just some nice statistics about the host environment itself. Very useful screen right here. Got a couple of tabs. As you can see, I have a couple of different defined networks as far as the cluster goes. I'll get to that more in a second. The roles that this particular node owns, disks that are associated, basically all of the information that consists of this cluster. The other thing that we've got is we've got some storage information. So this is any clustered storage that the cluster itself can see. Like I said, we need, just like VMware, we need shared storage in order for the cluster to function. And in situations where the cluster itself has an even number of nodes, you know, like my cluster here, it's just a two-node cluster, you know, from a vote perspective, there's two votes in the cluster. Well, what if each of them vote one way? That's not really going to work in a failover situation, right? So that's why you see this disk witnessing quorum. This is the cluster quorum disks, and it actually acts as a vote in the cluster. That way it has an uneven number of votes. So as far as determining whether the cluster is in a failed state from a Microsoft clustering perspective, this disk is needed. The other disk that you'll see in here is the cluster shared volume, or you'll hear a lot of Microsoft folks say CSV. This is what I would akin on the VMware side to a VMware data store. That's essentially what this is. It's just called cluster shared volume on the Hyper-V side. And this is where I'm storing all my virtual machines in this particular cluster. I'm not using pools in this cluster, so I'm not really gonna cover it. Mainly just using these disks which are shared via iSCSI in this particular cluster. That's why they show up here and not inside of pools. I mentioned I was going to cover networks here as well. What you'll do when you define a new cluster is these will actually show up and be labeled some really cryptic names, but you'll be able to see that the network segment that each of these reside on. And based on that information, you can determine what their functions are. You know, so you'll actually be able to go in here and rename these. So I know that everything in this 192.16.1 network is actually my production VM traffic, and I label it as such. The cluster and live migration traffic actually lives on this subnet, and I labeled it as such. So what this tells you here is I've actually segmented off the cluster heartbeat and the live migration, aka vMotion traffic, onto this subnet here. And like I said, I'm using iSCSI in the environment. It's just on a 192.168.0 subnet. And because both clustered nodes can see that, it's going to show up in networking here. And what I did is I labeled it. That way anyone, you know, any administrator coming behind me that looks into this, they can see that, oh, this network is iSCSI and the cluster use is none, because the only thing that's on that particular network is iSCSI traffic. And then you've got your, you know, cluster events. This is essentially your event viewer for the cluster. So that's Failover Cluster Manager. One other thing I like to point out in here is in VMware, high availability is more of a cluster, more of a cluster setting role, right? And this throws a lot of people off. High availability in Hyper-V is set at the VM level. So you'll see here my failover cluster roles. If they appear in here, the virtual machine is HA enabled. If you see a VM in Hyper-V Manager here that does not appear in Failover Cluster Manager, that means that machine is not HA enabled. I've had a lot of guys that I've worked with, they think that because they've set up a Hyper-V cluster that out of the gate everything is HA enabled, and that's not the case. They'll make a VM in Hyper-V Manager, and then it doesn't appear in Failover Cluster Manager. What you need to do to make that VM highly available is you need to come into Failover Cluster Manager, say configure role, and it's just going to be a wizard-driven thing. Scroll down to type virtual machine, hit next, And then you just select the VM that you want to make highly available in this screen and just continue through the wizard, and it will enable the VM for high availability, assuming all the correct conditions are set, things like, you know, the storage is visible to each node in the cluster, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm going to cancel out of that, and real quick, we're going to go into SCVMM. I'm not going to spend a lot of time in here because anyone who's used SCVMM knows that it does so much stuff that it can become very, very overwhelming. So as you can see right out of the gate, there's a lot here, right? The nice thing that VMM does for you is it allows you to kind of carve out your virtual environments in a couple of interesting ways, one of them being clouds. Cloud is kind of a unique identifier for groups of virtual infrastructure, right? So what I've done in this particular cluster, our test clusters, I've broken it out based on production. I've got a production cloud, which kind of runs some of the mission critical virtual infrastructure for this lab. And I've set some rules on this particular cloud to make sure that that stuff kind of runs as it should be all the time. But I've also got this dev cloud, and this is for other guys on my team that can come in and kind of make some VMs and test around with them. You can really break out your stuff in that manner, and it's kind of nice. You can also do some stuff with Azure subscriptions in this interface as well. Kind of gives you that single pane of glass management. VM networks, I don't have a whole lot in here, but any VM network, any virtual switch that VMM detects on any of the hosts, you're going to see in this area. Same thing with storage. Any storage that VMM detects that's associated with any of the VMs are going to show up in here. And then down here, you know, I like to akin this particular section of the interface with vCenter. Because in vCenter, you're used to that host and clusters view right out of the gate, and that's essentially what this all hosts section is. You're going to see your Hyper-V cluster name at the top, followed by the hosts and all the associated VMs that are running on them. So that's one of the nice things about this particular view. You got a couple other things here like fabric. This is essentially the fabric that makes up your virtual environment. That's like your network fabric, your storage fabric. VMM can do all kinds of crazy things with that type of fabric that unfortunately I don't have the time to cover all that today. That could be a whole day of courses just by itself. So definitely take some time and look into that if you're interested. A lot of good stuff right here on this screen that you know, I find a lot of people don't invest enough time into checking out. There's some really powerful things on the screen. The library is kind of interesting. The nice thing about this is it becomes kind of a central repository for your ISOs, your VHDs, any piece of media that is associated with your environment is going to get populated into here. As you can see, I've got a couple of different ISOs out here for my installs, for a couple Linux distributions, for the main Windows Server image I've used for the VMs in this particular lab, and a couple of other nice things. Jobs will kind of tell you all the running jobs in the environment at the time. You might see a couple of failures in here. I was tinkering with the lab. Well, actually, I look pretty good here, don't I? So I was expecting a couple errors. I was getting the demos ready yesterday. So, and then settings, this is VMM settings. Unfortunately, like I said, I don't have a whole lot of time to show much more of VMM here to you, but just at least wanted to point it out so that you know it was there. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to go back to my slide deck, and we're going to move on now to what we really came here to talk about today, and that's moving VMs from a VMware environment to a Hyper-V environment. Now, the primary tool that is used to do this, and this is the Microsoft preferred way of doing this at this point in time, is the MVMC tool, the Microsoft Virtual Machine Converter. Now, I keep hearing things back and forth about this in the Microsoft community. This functionality at one point in time was baked into System Center Virtual Machine Manager, which I just showed you. But then there was word they were deprecating it, and I've heard it kind of go back and forth a couple of times. But I know at this point in time, the time of this session, MVMC is the preferred method of doing what I'm about to show you. So this can be downloaded at the link at the right. And the first thing that you're going to notice out of the gate is, as you'll see here, it shows Microsoft Virtual Machine Converter 3.0. That is actually not the current version. The current version is 3.1, and this kind of threw me off when I went to grab the latest version the other day. This download is actually for 3.1. Even though it says 3.0, download it, go to install, and it's actually the 3.1 version. So just keep that in mind. That's thrown a couple of my buddies off over the last week or two here. So let's talk about some requirements that are centered around this tool. First of them being, what are the requirements of the source VM that I'm going to be converting? So, as you know, for the purposes of this session, we're focusing on VMware VMs. So I've got the VMware source VM requirements here. The tool requires that vCenter be running version 4.1, 5.1, or 5.5. Notice 5.0 is not in there. Not sure why the little gap in support there. I don't know many people still running 5.0, so I don't think it's much of a deal breaker, but I like to point that out. We've also got, you know, if you have a standalone ESX host that you want to convert, you've got that as well. 4.1, 5.1, and 5.5, kind of the same thing. As far as VMware hardware version goes, 4, 7, 8, 9, and 10 are all fully supported. So you got to make sure that your virtual hardware is one of those additions. And judging by the breadth of those additions, I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of problem there. That's quite a few additions, at least the additions that have been used in recent memory. Destination host requirements. What kind of requirements do we have on the Hyper-V host side? And these are mainly just the version requirements. What version of Hyper-V needs to be running at the target destination? First one being Hyper-V 2008 R2. You know, a little bit older version of Hyper-V, but it's still valid as far as this tool is concerned. Hyper-V 2012 and Hyper-V 2012 R2 are supported as well. And it doesn't matter the particular SKU of Hyper-V that's running. It could be the full GUI Hyper-V install. It could be a server core Hyper-V install. It could be the free Hyper-V server SKU as well. And keep in mind, between all those additions, the feature set's the same. The only difference really is the licensing capabilities that you get with that license, or with in the case of Hyper-V Server, the lack of licensing that you get along with it. So keep that in mind. And like I said earlier, Microsoft Azure VHD, that's an option with this requirement, with this tool as well, but we're not really going to cover it in this session. Just take note that if you attempt to do this, there's a couple extra steps with the Azure VHD piece. You have to set up some secure certificates with your Azure subscription, and then what it'll do, it'll actually convert it to an Azure VHD, which you have to create a blank VM inside of Azure and then attach the VHD to afterwards. But still very useful in getting certain workloads uploaded and into Azure. Supported guest VMs. You know, these are the guest VMs on the VMware side that the tool can actually convert and are officially supported. So, of course, all the recent versions of Windows are supported. Same thing on the client with Windows client. You know, Vista 7, 8, and 8.1, those are all fully supported to be converted by this client, this utility. We've got RHEL 5 and 6, CentOS 5 and 6. No big shockers there because they're kind of one and the same, just one without the branding, right? Ubuntu 10.04 and 12.04. So really you can kind of see the trend there. If you're familiar with Ubuntu at all, any of the long-term service releases are supported there. I think I got that right. I'm pretty sure the LTS stands for long-term service release. Anyway, any of the 04 designations for Ubuntu are supported. There's also support for Celeste 11, Debian 7, and Oracle Linux 5 and 6, which I kind of probably should have moved that up to the RHEL line as well, because that's kind of the same too, just a different variant. Other requirements. The host needs to have enough storage capacity, right? The target host. That's kind of not a big shocker there, but I'm surprised at how many people, you know, they try doing a conversion. They say, Andy, why? Why isn't it working? Well, you don't have enough storage. So that's kind of a no-brainer, but I feel obligated to point it out. User account must have write access to the UNC destination path, you know, the path where you're actually storing the virtual hard disk after conversion on the target machine. You know, the user that you're using to run the tool has to have access to that path. And then, you know, online conversions, they need to have the firewall disabled, RDP needs to be enabled, and VMware tools, you want to make sure that's up to date as well. Just kind of some general housekeeping things to make sure that you have a successful conversion. couple of requirements that that didn't make it into the slide deck. I intended to, but I didn't want to overload people with you know, I didn't want to do death by PowerPoint, essentially. Just a couple things I want to point out. You know, it has to be MVMC itself needs to be installed on a server 2012 R2 or 2008 R2 Service Pack 1 server. Those are the OSs that you can actually run this utility on. You need kind of a newer version of .NET, which, you know, for newer OSs is not a big deal. And you also need Visual C++ installed. And one other requirement here is the Bits Compact Server feature needs to be enabled inside of the OS. So keep all those requirements in mind. Linux-specific requirements. As you saw on that previous list, the list of OSs that are supported to be converted, there's a couple of Linux-specific requirements. One, SSH needs to be enabled. So SSH needs to be present, enabled, and running, and port 22 or whatever port you've configured for SSH. Well, I should just say, you know, keep it on port 22 for the purposes of this utility. That needs to be there, right? Root credentials are also needed, and I have a lot of Linux guys ask me, well, you know, does sudo work? Because Linux OSs like Ubuntu, for example, use sudo by default. You don't ever get the root password. It's randomly generated, and you create a user that just has full sudo access. Sudo is not supported, so you're going to have to go through the process in that situation of, you know, getting on the command line of a Linux box and running sudo passwd root to change the root password, and at that point, you'll be able to run this utility against that Linux install. Okay, so let's actually kind of walk through the process of using MVMC. I'm going to drop back to my lab environment here. And I'm going to open MVMC. So, very similar to most other Microsoft utilities that you're used to using. Very wizard-driven, right? So we're just going to click Next. And you can do virtual machine conversions, or you can do physical machine conversion as well. This is fully capable of doing physical machines, but for the purposes of this session, we're going to focus on, again, VMware and the virtual machine conversion type. So I'm going to say virtual machine conversion. I'm going to click Next. And then as you can see on the left-hand side, it changes all these different options that are associated with that type of conversion. And as I mentioned earlier, you're going to see Microsoft Azure inside of this wizard, which we're not going to cover today. So, you know, if you don't have an account, it gives you the option of making one here with this link. But again, we're not covering that today, so I'm going to move on to say migrate to Hyper-V. And again, you'll see some of the options over here change. So I'm going to select Hyper-V. I'm going to move on to the next step of the wizard, and it's going to ask me, what's the destination host? Which host are you moving this virtual machine to? And I'm going to type in, you can do either an IP or a host name. I'm going to do a host name because I'm terrible at remembering IPs. And I'm going to say tglab hv01.tglab.lcl. And you could say use the credentials that I'm currently using, or you can actually specify credentials as well. So I'm going to put in the domain administrator just because I know it has enough access. It's probably overkill for this, but I just wanted to make sure. And what it'll do, it'll validate the credentials, make sure it can talk to the host, and you're good to go there. Now the next, this is the destination path for the virtual hard disk storage. Where is it going to store this new VHD that you're converting? And one thing that I've noticed with this utility is sometimes when you click browse, you'll see that yes, it's looking at the destination Hyper-V host, but I don't have any folders to click on, right? That's a little strange. I'm sure that bug is going to be worked out, but until then, I found that actually putting in the hidden share of C or whatever volume that you want to use to do the conversion and then hitting browse will actually bring up that particular volume. So for the purposes of this, you know, just as an example, I'm going to go into clustered storage. Remember I mentioned that CSV earlier, that's kind of like a VMware data store. What the cluster will actually do is it will mount that cluster volume as this folder on each node in the cluster. So anything stored under C cluster storage on any of the hosts actually lives inside of that CSV. So just keep that in mind. So I'm just going to go in here and I'm just going to pick a folder. You can make a new folder based on the VM that you were storing if you want, but just for the purpose of this demo, I'm just going to pick this folder here and say okay. Then I have the option of saying a fixed size or dynamically expanding. Fixed size in the VMware world is the same as thick provisioned. I'm going to set aside all of that disk space for this VHD right at this point in time. Dynamically expanding is a thin provision disk. That's, you know, that's kind of what it's called on the VMware side. In the Microsoft world, you know, they say that there's no performance hit for dynamic expanding disks. You know, and they're starting to say it on the VMware side too. My problem with that method, and I'm sure a lot of folks have run into it, is, you know, you have to keep real close tabs on your storage allocation if you're going to use dynamically expanding disks. So keep that in mind. And then you get the option of choosing the file format. VHD you would select if you still have some older 2008 related Hyper-V servers in your cluster. You can't mix and match 2008 and 2012 Hyper-V hosts. But, you know, if you were ever going to move them to a Hyper-V host of that revision level, you'd want to make it a VHD. For all new Hyper-V hosts, you know, 2012, 2012 R2 and newer, you're going to select the VHD file type. So I'm going to say next. Now I'm going to have to define a source. Now I can define an ESX host in particular or the vCenter server. In this case, I'm going to say VC01, which is our lab vCenter server, and then I'm going to actually define the credentials to connect to that vCenter instance. So I'm going to use my domain, my lab domain credentials, and hope that I can type in my password under pressure. Oh, looks like we're good. And what it's going to do is it's going to go out and look at that vCenter instance, and it's going to pull down a list of all the VMs that reside on that vCenter instance. So I have there's a whole load of VMs out in this vCenter instance, and I'm just going to select VC02 for the purposes of this demo, just picking one at random. I'm going to hit next, and it's going to bring me to this next screen, this connection screen. So what credentials am I going to use to actually facilitate the conversion? Kind of the same thing. I can use my Windows user account that I'm running the utility with, or I can define one. And again, just to be on the safe side, probably overkill, I'm going to use the domain administrator. Now, these final two boxes down here, they do a couple of things. Final state of source virtual machine, final state of destination virtual machine. You know, I wish they changed the verbiage on this a little bit, just to make it a little bit more precise as to what's actually going on here. But, you know, basically this is defining whether you want the source VM to stay powered on or off, and the same for the destination VM. So you can choose what you want to there, depending on your cutover scenario, but you got a couple of options. Say next. Now, workspace. This is going to be a folder. You know, typically on the machine that's actually running the conversion, the machine that is actually running MVMC, that's going to temporarily store the information while it does the conversion. So you're going to need as much free space in this location as large as the converted VHDs are. So keep that in mind. I'm just going to say D, just because, you know, for the purpose of this demo. I'd say next. And it's going to go ahead and check things out and see if everything's going to be, you know, things are going to be successful with the conversion, and it's going to give you a summary. And, you know, right here I can see that all the video memory configured is greater than 4 megs. You know, it's just a warning. I can change that before the conversion if I want, but it'll give you some warnings here if it detects anything. At this point, I would just say finish, and away we go. So at that point, I'm just going to say cancel. And we're going to head back to the slide deck. So just to kind of build on top of that a little bit, we're not going to spend a ton of time talking about it, but I wanted to point out that there is another tool called the Migration Automation Toolkit. So the MVMC, which I just showed you, is great for those one-off conversions where I've got 1, 2, maybe 5, 6 virtual machines that I want to convert. how do I do large en masse conversions of entire virtual environments? And the Migration Automation Toolkit that I'm showing you here on this screen is one such tool. It'll actually use a collection of PowerShell scripts to automate conversions using MVMC. So it's a great automation toolkit. It's great for anyone that's into DevOps and the whole automation movement. Just a nice utility. So it can be downloaded, and you can read up more on it at that URL on the right-hand side. Real quick, what is MAT? It's a collection of PowerShell scripts that automates the MVMC procedure. And it really lets you do those scripted conversions of entire collections of VMs, like I said. And the other nice thing about it is it's scalable. Converting VMs is a very compute-intensive process and storage-intensive too. You know, you can scale this out to a couple of different servers all running MVMC, all doing different conversions at the same time. So for those very large conversion processes, the Migration Automation Toolkit is a big help. Requirements for MAT, real quick, kind of a no-brainer. MVMC must be reachable in some way, shape, or form. SQL is required. You could use an existing SQL server on-premise, or you could just install SQL Express inside of the same machine that's running MVMC. The user account has to have rights to run MVMC, no surprise there. A user account should also have rights to schedule tasks on remote machines, so this is going to have to be like some sort of power user account at the very least. Power CLI on the VMware side is needed to collect some information on the VMware VMs, and you're also going to need the credentials for the target ESXi and vCenter instances, so no big surprises there. So to wrap up, again, you know, a Hyper-V cluster isn't all that different in deployment from vSphere. Yes, the management experience is a little different, but, you know, from a high-level overview, it's generally the same. The other thing to do is to remember that there's three different management interfaces. And some people would say, yes, that's overcomplicated, and maybe it is. But the fact is that the nice thing about it is there's a different management tool for each situation that you might be in. There's a different management tool based on the size of the cluster, which I think is nice. You can also use MVMC for basic conversions, you know, like those onesie twosies like I talked about. And also MAT, which we just talked about, is going to provide more functionality for those larger conversion jobs. So from there, I want to say thank you, and we've got a little bit of time for questions. Rob, we got any questions out there that anyone has?
Hold on, I'm here.
All right.
First one is SCVMM necessary for creating virtual machine templates?
You know, that's always an interesting question. To make true VM templates, the technical answer is yes. But with Hyper-V Manager, you can kind of do the same thing. What you would do is you'd make your gold image or a template, whatever template you want to make. You'd make that VM, sysprep it, and then you can actually export that VM to a file share. And from there, what you do is you saw the import button I kind of mentioned when I was showing off Hyper-V Manager. When you hit that import button and point it to the folder that contains that VM you created, it'll give you the option of saying, hey, am I making a copy of this VM or am I importing it as is? And if you say I'm making a copy, it's going to give the VM a unique UID. It'll give it a unique UID, which essentially to Hyper-V means it's a new unique virtual machine. And then you boot the machine, let sysprep do its thing, and you essentially have a new VM based on the image you created. So that's kind of a poor man's way of doing templates without SCVMM. Great question.
Yeah, you can install file based. So it's Windows. If you know Windows, you're in the file based and import. So
exactly. Yep.
Another one here, do you find that the MVMC does a good job of conversions? Have you come across any examples of where an MVMC conversion didn't work for some reason?
You know, I find some of the same results as I've had with the VMware converter in the past. If you've got a machine that's just getting hammered with I/O for some reason, or another great example is AV. If AV is running and just hammering the file system, you're going to have a rough time getting that machine converted. So, you know, for those folks that have used the VMware converter in the past, some of the same rules and guidelines apply.
Yeah, I think in my experience in the past, if there's a lot of if you can cut down some of the services during the migration, it seems to work well as well. So
yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yep. That's that stuff will get you if you're not careful.
Yep. Here's one. There used to be an issue with doing physical machine migrations. So I seem to remember it didn't support UEFI firmware on the physical box. Is that resolved?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I can't think of anything in the recent past where I've run into that particular issue. Generation 2 virtual machines and Hyper-V kind of gave you that secure boot methodology that goes along with UEFI. So I'd be surprised if that was still an issue. But what I can do, if you want to drop me an email, I can get you a definite answer on that one way or the other. Great question.
Here's another one. Yeah, I think you explained a little bit of this, but can you explain when you might use like maybe size of business for Hyper-V Manager, Failover Cluster Manager, or SCVMM?
You know, there's no real blanket answer for that. You know, it's kind of based on the needs of the organization. I found with, you know, if you're not doing any clustering, it's all standalone hosts, you're going to want to use Hyper-V Manager. But if you have a small cluster, maybe 2 to 10 hosts, I would say Failover Cluster Manager is really just fine. You can do a lot with Failover Cluster Manager, and you can do a lot with PowerShell to go along with that as well. As far as VMM goes, VMM is intended for large enterprises and large hosters, and a lot of enterprises that already have it just use it for Hyper-V management by default. So, you know, like I said, there's no blanket answer, but that's kind of what I've gone with over the last couple of years.
Yep. I got one more here. How important is learning PowerShell with Hyper-V?
How important is learning PowerShell? I love that question. It's not just important to learn it from a Hyper-V perspective, but that's the direction that Microsoft is going, right? You know, just coming from Ignite last week, I want to say in just about every session that I attended, it was mentioned to everyone to be learning PowerShell. And some people don't like that because, now I feel like I'm going backwards. I'm using a command line interface again. And to the people that are worried about learning it, I always like to say that just start trying it. The syntax is very intuitive. It's very easy to learn. And once you start using it and seeing some of the powerful things that it can do, I think you're going to be sold on it. So I would definitely say yes, start learning it, because you can do some fancy things with PowerShell that fill some of the same roles and functions that you get with Virtual Machine Manager. So you might be able to get away without having to run System Center in your environment if you want some of those really advanced, fancy tools.
Andy. Yeah. We're just shy of 10 minutes to the hour, and you can continue to answer a few questions while I display some polls. For our audience, the polls will appear to the left side of their viewing screen.
All right. Sounds good.
I got one more, Andy, here.
Sure.
Is the uninstallation of VMware tools a manual process post-conversion, or is it handled during the conversion?
That is actually a good question. I think from the last couple of times I've done this, I've had to go manually remove them. I don't know. Have you run into that before, Rob?
I think it is a post-process like other services. That's just as you would a physical of, you know, say you had an HP box and you had a bunch of HP services on there. I think it is a post-process.
Yeah, because, you know, one of the requirements during the conversion is that VMware tools be latest and greatest. And I think part of that is just to ensure that the virtual drivers are latest for the actual conversion process to ensure a higher rate of success. But I do seem to remember that it is a manual removal after the fact. We got any more, or are we?
That is our last question. It's in the last call for any questions, but that was our last one.
All right. Well, again, I want to thank everyone for attending the session. I want to thank Rob for moderating for us. Did a great job. And again, just want to thank all of the great folks that put this together for us over at Microsoft.